All right, it's good to be here. I'm assuming everybody hears me. If you don't, then if you don't hear anything, then certainly let me know. I'm with the law firm of Fisher & Phillips. I'm a partner. I've been a partner since 2005, so for 16 years. I'm a native of Southern California. I'm living in Texas full-time. However, I still have a home in California and travel back and forth quite a bit now that the pandemic will hopefully soon be easing up. I'll be doing a little bit more of that. But I do a lot of work here just from my home, and it works just fine. And I've been practicing wage and hour law since 2000, when they first had AB 60 passed, when Governor Davis was governor, introducing 500 new labor code statutes into the law, which revolutionized California law in so many ways, including introducing meal and rest period laws, when beforehand they never were in the labor code. They were only in the wage orders, which initially were promulgated only on behalf of minors and women back in the 1940s, I believe. And now eventually they were expanded to the broader population. But the origin of the meal and rest period laws come from just protecting women in the workforce and minors. They didn't think that men needed any protection. Of course, now we know that's not true. We're all kind of in the same boat here. Just to confirm, does everyone hear me okay?
I am not getting any messages that say they cannot, so I'm okay. Going to say yes.
Fantastic. Very good. Okay. Again, I joined the law firm of Fisher & Phillips in 1998 after serving in the federal courts for 6 years, both as a law clerk, permanent law clerk for a federal judge, and also a staff attorney at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, Louisiana. So I've had an interesting, colorful past in the courts, done a lot of wage and hour law, class actions, and everything else. Before going to law school, I worked for the Clorox company, actually, in their management program. So I was in a manufacturing plant, union organized, and I was there for 8 years. So I've had a lot of different experiences while I was working at the Clorox company. I also taught school in the evenings, personnel management. So it's been an interesting background, and jumping into the law and getting into employment from the standpoint of the practice of law, it's been really, really interesting. I understand both the practicalities of the courts making their rulings, also the practicalities of employers applying the law in the workplace, and also from the advisory standpoint from associations. And so it's really been very helpful. My background has given me some advantages, I believe, that's helped me in these areas have some success. So let's talk then about the topic of today, this meal and rest period penalty issue. The penalties actually weren't introduced until the year after the statute for meal periods was introduced. And because they realized that it's one thing to have a statute, it's another thing not to have any teeth in the statute. You could get an injunction against an employer, forcing them to make them give breaks to employees, but they figured they would get a little bit more traction if they added some monetary value to it and actually made them pay an hour premium, which was very common in labor unions. They would always like to pay people an extra hour somehow associated with a meal period. It just seems to be the thing that they've been doing for many years. So you kind of see where that came from. So anyway, let's kind of back up just a little bit and introduce the topic. Now, I believe I have an hour. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
Or longer if you need it. Okay. I set aside an hour and a half.
Okay. Well, let's see how it plays out. I certainly have the time to do an extra half hour if we need it. Anyway, so how are the wage and hour laws created in California? Well, we have the California Labor Code. It's a very expansive, voluminous labor code that has everything from workers' compensation to all aspects of employment, litigating in the labor commissioner's office. They tell you what you need to do there. Just a ton of things that's covered by the labor code, not merely just overtime and things like that. But overtime is, in fact, in the labor code as well. And it's been made far more detailed after Gray Davis's AB 60 legislation that he signed. So anyway, we have the Industrial Welfare Commission wage orders, and these are, there's about 17 of them. And typically in auto dealerships, it's going to be wage order 7, although a couple courts have erroneously said that wage order 4 applied as well because it talks about technicians. But that's really incorrect. It's really just going to be wage order 7 throughout the entire dealership, including the technicians. Although, you know, we have some imprecision there that the courts have created. Then we have decisions by the California Supreme Court, the California appellate cases, which are interpreting the California Labor Code and the wage orders. And then, of course, we also have the Division of Labor Standards Enforcement. You've probably gone to those hearings and conciliation conferences. They give guidance on what they're enforcing, but they're supposed to go no further than what is established in the wage orders and the labor code and in the case law. Sometimes they try to go beyond there and be advocates for employees. It's sadly so, but that happens here in California. And then there's, of course, federal cases that are interpreting California law, because if you have diversity of parties and you're required to be in federal court, then the federal courts have to decide what California law is. They're not binding precedent, because you know, it's only done for purposes of what they call an eerie guess guideline. But you know, it's interesting that when the federal courts rule on California law, it's amazing how often the state courts agree, and sometimes even the Supreme Court agrees. And so the federal courts sometimes do help shape and frame California law. Okay, so we have a lot of legal developments going on in California. We have the minimum wage. It's been an ongoing, you wouldn't think it would be an issue that a technician making $75,000 a year would somehow claim that the minimum wage was violated. Well, that's all part of the technicalities of how the law has been interpreted, where situations where allegedly some kinds of work have not been paid for. So there's been a lot of litigation about that, and even for commission-paid employees. Then we have the issue of regular rate, and it's been around a long time. How do we calculate the regular rate? It's typically the same as the federal law rule, except with a couple exceptions, including flat sum bonuses and salaried non-exempt people. There's a different formula for the regular rate there. But it's important to know the regular rate, because then you need to know how to calculate overtime, because overtime is 1.5 times the regular rate for regular overtime and 2.0 times the regular rate for double time. And so we have to know what that rate itself is first before we can assess how much overtime is owed. And as we'll soon discuss, it's important also to know what kind of a premium employees get for meal and rest period violations, because the premium is 1 hour of pay, we know now, at the regular rate of pay. I have always viewed it to be the regular rate of pay for purposes of overtime calculation. It just seemed like the courts got off base for a while and they had to be jerked back in line by the California Supreme Court. Anyway, then there's this non-productive issue. And this goes back to the issues with technicians and other classifications. If they're engaging in non-productive activity, is it paid for at all? It should be. And if it's not, you have to do pay supplements. You're not paying the base hourly rate for all of his work. But there's been a big discussion as to what is non-productive activity. There's even a case that decided whether it was unconstitutional for us to require employers to pay separately for non-productive activity when it's not even defined what non-productive activity is. But the court said, yeah, it's clear enough. You guys will figure it out, you know, along the way. So we know that it's not unconstitutional, although somebody thought it was, Section 226.2 of the Labor Code. Okay, so why is overtime relevant to meal and rest periods? Well, we know it's relevant because the regular rate for overtime purposes is the penalty that's assessed for every day when one or more meal periods are not provided or not provided appropriately, or when one or more rest periods are not provided or not provided appropriately. So it's that 1 hour rate that's important. And so in California, contrary to federal law, where there's only one overtime zone, and that is over 40, in California, there's 5 overtime zones, which involve either time and a half or double time. And so I'm sure you know what it is, but it's just California law is a little bit more complicated. But the regular rate is a little bit more simple of a calculation in most cases. So what overtime is due? Okay, so when you pay somebody bonuses and other types of pay that's for periods that go beyond a pay period, you'll have to square things up at the end and pay overtime, the equivalent amount of overtime due for that bonus or incentive payment. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But the bottom line is that If you have to pay, I mean, the law regarding regular rates has pretty much stayed the same for several years. I mean, for quite a while, more than a decade. So if you know already that you're having to pay overtime on a bonus because it's an additional amount, that automatically tells you, puts you on notice that you have to pay supplemental overtime to, or I'm sorry, supplemental premium payments for meal and rest period violations. You have to pay supplements because those too are owed in future intervals. Okay, so if you get a monthly bonus that increases the regular rate by $250 an hour, then you have to retroactively pay $250 for every hour of meal and rest period penalties that have been assessed in any week. And it will also be the case if you're paying sick pay to people based on the regular rate. There's two options to pay sick pay. One is the regular rate in the week in which the time was lost, and the other is the rate that results from a 90-day look back in the full prior pay periods over the past 90 days. Either one of those rates is correct. So far, you don't have to pay the greater rate of the two. You can just pick one. But the problem is, I think eventually they may ultimately amend it and say that you got to pay the greater of the two. So far, so good, though. You can choose one. So if you choose the regular rate in the pay period in which the sick pay is lost, then that will have to be supplemented. It has nothing to do with meal and rest periods, but I was trying to explain that payments that you make in the future that cover the week, it doesn't have to exclusively cover, it could be 1 week among 12 weeks. But if there's money that's allocated to that week from overtime that's due, then you know automatically that you're going to owe a supplement for sick pay if you base sick pay on the regular rate, and you'll owe it for the meal period premiums as well. So anyways, this is kind of an introduction to where we're going here. Overtime then is based at the regular rate of pay. And so first and foremost, you have to calculate the regular rate correctly. If you don't calculate it correctly, for example, if you have flat sum bonuses or other types of pay where you're not doing it correctly, then when you pay a premium based on that and the premium itself is not calculated correctly because the regular rate's not calculated correctly, then you know that you're just mass producing errors. Even if you try to, you know, supplement, you're not supplementing it correctly if you're not doing any of your math right. So just be sure to get the math right. So why we're here today is the Farah versus Lowe's Hollywood case. It was decided on July 15th, 2021. And it's all based upon this wonderful labor code statute, 226.7. And in this statute, it says that no one is permitted to work, to be required to work. No employee can be required to work during a meal or rest period or recovery period. Remember the heat recovery periods? Mandated pursuant to the wage order. And if you do that, if you do require them to work or they don't get a compliant meal period, which can be done in meal or rest period, and there's various ways to be out of compliance, and we can talk about that later, but they have to be paid an additional hour of pay at the employee's regular rate of compensation for each work day that the meal or rest or recovery period is not provided. So you don't have to total up all your meal period violations in one day and then pay if you have three, or you can only have a maximum of two meal period violations because there's only two meal periods that you get, right? But you don't have to pay 2 hours if you didn't give somebody their two meal periods in a day in which they work 16 hours. You only pay 1 hour because it's in each category of break. You only get a maximum of 1 hour a day. So anyway, so that's the deal right there, is that you got to pay this hour of pay. And so we can break these down individually. You know, for meal periods, we know that there's a standard for meal periods. You can't work them more than 5 hours without providing that meal period to them, or more than 10 hours without providing a second meal period to them. Okay, and so that's the rule. There is a way to waive it, but you can only waive it in narrow circumstances. And waiving it means you don't even have to relieve them of duty. Now, that's different than when you relieve somebody of duty and they decide to keep working and you let them keep working. I don't recommend it, by the way, because their story later is going to be different. But if you have relieved them of duty and you permit them to work nonetheless because they got to get caught up on stuff or whatever, there is no violation. You don't owe a penalty. and you have not waived the meal period, the employee is not officially waived because you've actually relieved the employee, and the employee is basically working off duty. It's kind of a nutty thing, but that's what the Supreme Court said in the Brinker case, I believe back in 2013 or 2011. But the bottom line is we don't think you should do that. You probably should. It's better to just make sure that your time records look beautiful, so when you're audited, nothing looks out of line. Anyway, so the meal period compliance penalty, the timing is, again, it has to begin no later, the first meal period, than the end of the fifth hour of work. What that means by the end of the fifth hour of work is when you have 5.0 hours on the clock. It doesn't mean by the end of the sixth hour, which is 6.0. So you start work at 8. If an employee starts work at 8, they got to begin the meal period by no later than 1 o'clock. That's when you have 5.0 complete hours on the books. And that's important. And I wouldn't even let anybody get close to it. Have them start earlier. Have them start their meal period so that when they come back, there's still plenty of time left to prevent a violation. So don't get really close to the end. So one possibility of a violation is if the person starts a meal period late. Okay. The next one is that they skip it altogether. That's nasty because the time card will show no meal period there. And so we know now after the Donahue case that the presumption is that the person didn't get a meal period and it was your fault as an employer. You have to prove that it wasn't. I mean, so it's always good to not let that happen so that your time cards look beautiful. So there is no issue to begin with. There's also a short meal period where somebody stops at 25 minutes, or we know in the Donahue case where the person took a 25-minute break, but the rounding put them up to 30, and they said, hey, there's no violation there, but we know there was because it's real minutes. It's not rounded minutes, okay? So a short meal period can be a problem. If it's the employee's fault and it's not your fault, technically you don't owe a penalty because they just wanted to come back early, or maybe they wanted to cha-ching, get an extra hour by punching in early. The Supreme Court of California says that employees aren't entitled to a one-hour premium in any situation where they do it themselves by ignoring the rule for a personal advantage. So we know it's not due, but you need to prevent them from even doing it. I mean, Brinker says that you don't have to police people, but you should police people. I'm sorry. It's just safer that way to not have a situation where you're dealing with that. There's another situation where somebody did punch out for a meal break. They punched out for it, but they remained working during the meal break. So they're actually working. So that's an on-duty meal period that wasn't it's an on-duty meal period that's not valid. It has to be valid in order for it to be legal. And we can talk about that at another time. But the bottom line is, it's either on duty, you didn't relieve them of duty, it's going to be short, or it's going to be skipped, or it's going to be late. So any of those situations create a potential problem for liability. Okay, now, so what's the standard for meal breaks? And I'm going through this just for the purposes of summarizing things here. And so the standard is, all you have to do as an employer to comply with the law is that you have to relieve employees of all duty, relinquish control over their activities, permit them a reasonable opportunity to take an uninterrupted 30-minute break in which they are free to come and go as they please, and must not impede or discourage employees from taking their meal period. Okay, so there's some subtleties built into that. So, people take advantage of that. So just make sure they take it so they don't have any arguments. Then, now, employers may not undermine a formal policy providing meal breaks by pressuring employees to perform their duties in ways that omit breaks. So like enforcing a scheduling policy that makes taking breaks extremely difficult. So you have to have an active role in this in order to avoid having problems. Okay, so the existence of a time card deviation does not establish a meal period violation if the deviation was caused by the employee and not by the employer. Otherwise, employees would be motivated to record deviations in order to demand a one-hour premium. We know that they cannot do that, but still, we need to make sure that they're not monkeying around at the time. We need to do an investigation every time there is a deviation on a time record to figure out what happened. So there's this burden after this new case. We had a prior case that came out that said that a time card deviation does not establish a presumption of violation by the employer. But then we had Donahue versus AMN Services come forward at February 25th, 2021 of this year, where the court said it does create a burden. It doesn't mean you're automatically liable. It just means that you now have to prove that it wasn't your fault, it was the employee's fault, in order to avoid having to pay the premium. Okay, so now rest periods. This is a little different area here. This wasn't addressed in FERA. It was only what the 1 hour premium is in FERA. But the rest periods are clear. We have to authorize and permit all employees to take rest periods, which are in the middle of the work period, for every 4 hours of work or major fraction thereof. And it'll be 10 minutes rest time. You don't count the time they're walking to the break room as part of the 10 minutes. They get it when they get to the break room, they get a full 10 minutes. Some employers give people a 15-minute break to allow them enough time to get to the break room and back. And so, you know, it gets interesting when people are traveling around a lot. Now, of course, if an employee is only working less than 3.5 hours, they don't get a break at all. But if they work 3.5 hours or more, then they do get that break. Now, once again, in the wage orders, and this is basically quoting directly from the wage order, if an employer doesn't provide a rest period in accordance with the provisions of the wage order, you once again have to pay 1 hour of pay at the regular rate of compensation for each work day that technically 1 hour periods are not provided. Okay. Now, in addition to this, our third area, this basically the three-headed monster, you know, meal periods, rest periods, and heat recovery periods. That's the third head on the monster. So the Occupational Safety and Health Standards Board, they adopted this section 3395 of the OSHA regulations that provides, among other things, that employees must be allowed and encouraged to take a preventative cool-down rest in the shade when they feel the need to do so to protect themselves from overheating. Now, this certainly came from the agricultural workers in the San Joaquin Valley. That's where a lot of this drama came from, because they do work in extremely hot conditions, and there's been injuries, even death, you know, due to heat exhaustion working there. So this addresses that situation. The access to the shade, to shade, must be permitted at all times. An individual employee who takes a preventative cool down rest period must be monitored and asked if he or she is experiencing symptoms of heat illness. The employee must be encouraged to remain in the shade, must not be ordered back to work until any signs or symptoms of heat illness have abated, but in no event less than 5 minutes, in addition to the time needed to access the shade. So this 5 minute heat down, you know, cool down period here is something that has to be paid as well. Now, a lot of people don't realize this, but if you're paying that special rest period premium, like for a technician who's getting paid based on flag production, if that technician also takes a 5 minute heat recovery period, then that 5 minutes has to be added to the total rest period minutes and coming up with what amount of pay is owed them for that period. You can't average that heat recovery time into the productive time in determining rate. You have to include that. So just be aware of that. And this involves, you know, if the temperature in the work area exceeds 80 degrees, you know, then you have to provide access to the shaded area and all that. So there's certain statutes. There's one part that actually requires you to force them to take the break and in really high temperatures, but that appears to be limited to a narrow range of employees. But bottom line is they need to be safe and need to take an active role in that. And again, they get the 1 hour premium if you do not provide them with opportunity to take the heat recovery period. Now, this is an area that is just not really hit the fan yet, but it's something I think, you know, when lawyers get, when they run out of things to sue about, they're going to look to a statute like this, and they're going to talk to their employees that work outside, and they're going to say, oh, this applies to you, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, it does. And, you know, were you ever told that you could take a break? Oh, no. And did we ever forced to keep working? Oh, yeah. Was it more than 80 degrees? Yes. So, you know, there's an ample opportunity for litigation here. So now the Farrah versus Lowe's Hollywood case, it all came down to what is that 1 hour of compensation at the regular rate of compensation. What does that mean? And there was just a debate as to whether it was just the base rate at the time or whether it would include bonuses or other types of pay that were made available or that were paid in the pay period when the hourly wages were paid, or even those incentives that were paid in periods beyond the pay period but included performance in the pay period. And so a lot of employers were just excluding that altogether and only paying it based upon the base hourly rate or some other rate that wasn't truly the regular rate true up. And so, that was debated there. I think the courts, unfortunately, they interpret it to be just the base hourly rate, that you didn't have to include incentive pay or other things like that. And so it got people a little bit off base for a while. So what was the practice at Lowe's Hollywood Hotel? Okay, now Miss Farah was a bartender. And if Farah's time record indicated she did not have a meal period, then Lowe's just automatically paid this employee an hour of pay at only the employee's base hourly rate without factoring any remotely calculated quarterly incentive payments into that hourly rate. So the bottom line, it looks like Lowe's just kind of did it the easy way. They just took the rate at the time. They looked at the time card. Was it a deviant time card? Automatically paid it. And so there's a couple problems there. Is number one, the rate was wrong, because Ms. Farah actually made a quarterly bonus that should have been added a supplemental portion of that. The amount that the regular rate increased should have been added to her pay, but it was not. And another thing they did, believe it or not, which I personally consider was wrong, is that they paid an hour premium without doing an investigation. I assume they didn't do an investigation. They just did it the easy way. They looked at a deviation and just automatically paid it. You would think that that was maybe humanitarian and nice of them to do that. But, in the end, though, you pay a premium, you're sort of admitting that there was a violation. And then if you admit there was a violation, then attorneys are going to get PAGA penalties. Even if you pay the premium, that doesn't close the issue. They'll try to get a PAGA penalty for a violation in that period. So even though you think that you've done well and you don't have to worry because you paid the premium, that doesn't end the suffering. You could still get a PAGA penalty for that pay period, and you can add that up, and that could be another several hundred thousand dollars in getting a case settled. So the court overruled in the Farah case, the court overruled the appellate court and found no evidence that the regular rate of compensation means hourly wages only, but rather it ruled, like it should have, that the phrase meant the regular rate used in calculating overtime compensation, which has been defined by law. And if you go back into the legislative history, it becomes very clear. The courts were using these expressions interchangeably, regular rate of compensation with regular rate of pay, to mean the regular rate for purposes of calculating the overtime. So for workers paid a guaranteed hourly rate plus an incentive, bonus, or piecework earnings for efficient performance, the regular rate is greater, therefore, than the minimum base rate. It may be time that if somebody's only getting $15 an hour, then the regular rate will be $15 an hour, clearly. But if a person's getting $15 an hour plus bonuses or other incentives, then $15 won't be the regular rate. It might be the only rate that you know at the time to be the regular rate, because they may or may not get those bonuses that they're planning on getting later on. Okay, so there's nothing illegal about paying them $15 if they're getting bonuses and other types of compensation, if that other compensation is not due and payable until some future time in the future. So you're fully complying with the law with paying the amount that you actually owe in the week, in the pay period when the violation occurs. And then if there is a violation, you do investigate that. And then you can just true it up later. You don't have to prepay a quarterly bonus thinking that just maybe the bonus is going to be X amount. No, you don't have to advance that money or engage in a speculation as to what future incentive compensation will be done. You can wait until you know what that is. And the same thing goes for a monthly bonus. If you have a semi-monthly pay period and they're getting $15 an hour as a BDC employee, but they get bonuses based on, X amount of dollars. But in order to get those dollars, they have to have a certain monthly criteria to qualify. And you won't know until the month if they're, CSI or whatever measurement you're using to get the full bonus. You won't know until the end of the month. Then you can wait until the monthly bonus becomes payable and then take the bonus itself, divide it into the appropriate hours, and then come up with the rate and add that rate to what's already been paid. So that's what you can do. And we'll have some examples of that. So again, the law only requires for most bonuses that are production in nature that you pay 50% premium for the amount of that bonus once you get the regular rate on the bonus, or 100% premium for double time. Now, remember, there's a little different calculation for flat sum bonuses. So if that bonus is a CSI bonus, you're going to have to use a different method of calculating the regular rate, which would be the amount of the CSI bonus for the month divided by all non-overtime hours in the month. And that will be the additional rate that's added to the regular rate that you have to pay later retroactively to all of the applicable weeks within the month when there was a meal period violation. Well, why don't you just get rid of the violation? You wouldn't have to worry about this. We can stop right now. Okay, no more violations. You don't ever have to do it anymore. You don't have to pay it. You can do that. And that's what I basically said in the article that we wrote, for all of our clients in California and across the nation. Me and another associate, Ashton Riley, wrote an article. And in that article, I added my 2 cents worth. You know, he basically wrote the article, but they like to give them to me so that I can put my special touches to it. And so I read the article and I came to this conclusion toward the end of the article. I was thinking, this is crazy. All these people paying meal and rest periods out there, what are they doing? Are they just paying it automatically because of a time card deviation? Are they doing this because they're not investigating? They're not controlling their people? This is terrible. They either need to clean their act up or just do an investigation and don't pay the penalty if it's not due. So I put in a comment there that, you know, the real issue here many times will not be whether I should pay a 1 hour premium, but the question is whether I should pay it at all because there wasn't a violation. And I put that in there. Then later I started hearing grumblings through the network. Well, that sounds like a snide remark to say that. You shouldn't be, you know, so anyway. I tweaked it a little bit in the official version there, but that was my honest feeling at the time, is that I was disappointed. I was deflated that people are paying so many premiums out there. We need to get out of the premium business and get out of the business by doing a better job at making sure that there are no violations. And so that was my point. So again, we need to calculate these things right. The Farah case was a good case because it forced all the employers to, I mean, we're getting calls from people as if they never even knew what the regular rate was. I mean, the law didn't change. I mean, the regular rate is the regular rate that's calculated for overtime purposes, but it's amazing all the work that's come into our offices about the regular rate. It's just, you know, and so we're, you know, I don't mind, you know, this is kind of fun, you know, talking about the regular rate. I kind of get off on math, you know, and it's really, this has been really good, but I feel bad though, that maybe some weren't all ready for this. And maybe some were paying the base wage because it would seem easier to do it that way. And they really had no clue that there could be another problem if the court ruled differently on that. Okay. So California has special rules for calculating the regular rate for employees paid flat sum bonuses, as I said before, and non-exempt salaries. A non-exempt salary regular rate is calculated like if you have a warranty administrator who's getting $4,000 a month, then you figure out the weekly equivalent of that. $4,000 times 12 is $48,000 divided by 2050, and you'll get the equivalent rate. You multiply that rate times 40 hours and get the weekly salary, but you have to divide that by 40, okay, in order to get that regular rate. I mean, that's the key thing. You in California, you have to divide the weekly salary by no greater than 40 hours. And federal law, under the flexible work week test, you can divide the salary by all hours worked. And so sometimes the more hours they work, the lower the regular rate is. But in California, they don't allow that. So that's something to realize if you're dealing with. I don't really like paying non-exempt people salaries, and that's a topic for another day. I wouldn't recommend that you do that, and I can tell you why, but anyway, that's what we're dealing with. So the regular rate calculation, basically, the regular rate for non-discretionary bonuses is typically calculated by dividing the bonus earned by all hours worked over the performance period. And I'm not talking about flat sum bonuses. I'm talking about just a regular performance bonus. Then you pay overtime as 50% of that regular rate and double time as 100% additional dollars in addition to that, the rate paid. Okay. Now, here's something that's important to realize. if more than one work week is involved in earning the bonus, there are two methods for calculating the regular rate. Okay. If the bonus cannot be allocated among the work weeks in proportion to the amount of the bonus the employee actually earned each week, the employer may assume that the employee earned an equal bonus amount each week of the period. So if they got a production bonus of, so many dollars, you can divide that into each of the weeks equally to come up with the bonus amount and what the regular rate would be for each of those weeks. Now, a production bonus is kind of weird, though, because you have to work to get a production bonus, and only logic tells you that you're going to be working more in some weeks than others. So you probably should divide the total bonus into the total hours worked so that you'll know what the value of the hour is, so that in weeks when they work overtime, they're going to be paid based on that, on that rate that's calculated that way. So that this is the second method. If there are circumstances which would make it inappropriate to assume the equal bonus earnings for each work week, such as production bonuses where unequal amounts are earned each week, it may be reasonable and equitable to assume that the employee earned the same amount of bonus each hour of the pay period. Okay. And this comes from the federal regulations. In California, Judge Schneider in the Central District of California, she acknowledged that there are these two methods, and I think other courts have as well. But California has not spent a lot of time talking about this, and I guess I shouldn't either, only to help you if you have a question on that. Typically, for production bonuses, our clients are dividing the bonus into all hours worked in the pay period and coming up with that equivalent rate, and then using that to get the regular rate in a production bonus scenario. Okay, so... Now, let's talk about flat sum bonuses. I know I talked about it already, but I'm going to talk about it again because this is an area of potential tripping it up here. California has already treated salaried non-exempt employees different than federal law. That occurred many years ago in the Tidewater case. I believe this might have even been, it was either in the 80s or in the 90s sometime, and it's been a long time. It kind of blurs when you get as old as I am. You know, you start forgetting which decade it was decided in. But bottom line is that the salaried non-exempt individuals, it's divided by 40 hours. We just talked about that. And then we have this decision, Alvarado versus Dark Container Corporation in 2018. I remember when that case came down. I had a lot of fun with that case. It created a new formula for flat sum bonuses. And this was influenced by the Labor Commissioner guidance. And analogizing to the treatment of non-exempt salaries in California, the court then expanded the law to this notion of flat sum bonuses, which are not by their nature production driven. And it all goes down to this. Okay, if you pay somebody a retention bonus, you're just rewarding them to being your employee. Okay, they didn't have to work extra hours to get it. They only had to be employed. Or they got a CSI bonus for had the highest CSI of any employee. They didn't have to work more hours to get it. And in fact, had they worked more hours, there might have been a greater risk of a lower CSI because they get tired and they get grouchy. So there's no relationship to whether they got the CSI and how many hours they worked in most cases. So why would you divide such a bonus, such a flat sum bonus that never goes up, a flat amount, by all hours worked when they would have gotten it regardless of how many hours they worked? So the court says you just have to divide it by all the non-overtime hours in the period. And there's a lot of different bonuses that are that type. There's merit bonuses, there's show-up bonuses, there's seniority bonuses, there's customer service bonuses, which really... They're not unit bonuses that are rewarding volume of work performed. And even if they did, even if you got a bonus for being the highest producer of everybody in the department, the bonus itself, if it's just $1,000, there's a really good argument that that's also a flat sum bonus because it didn't matter how many hours you worked. It only mattered that you were at number one in the tier of after adding up everybody's performance. So, it may be a gray area of sorts, but I think there is an argument that even that's a flat sum. Okay. So the principle underlying the ruling was when a flat bonus value is paid for reasons other than production, payable even if the employee works no overtime at all during the relevant pay period, the bonus is properly treated as if it were fully earned by only the non-overtime hours in the pay period, and therefore only non-overtime hours should be considered when calculating the bonuses per hour value. Adaptation required to the regular rate base in an Excel calculator now, and this, those of you, many of you did alter your calculator so you would have a pay supplement line, you would add a pay supplement line to your to populate the base. And I'm not trying to confuse anybody on this, but remember, a typical calculator that many of our clients have used is that they pay like $14 an hour for all hours worked, including the overtime hours. Okay. And then they pay overtime itself at 50% or 100%. But you have this interesting problem with the flat sum bonus. With the flat sum bonus, it's only paying for non-overtime hours. It's not paying for any overtime. So when it comes to overtime, you have to pay it the full 1.5 times the value of the bonus, the hourly value of the bonus. You can't pay 50%. So how can you compensate for that so that you can continue to only pay 50% and 100%? To compensate for that, you would have to pay a supplement, a pay supplement, or the 1.0 portion of the one, the 1.0 portion for all hours worked. So if the flat sum bonus rate was 150, you would pay 150 an hour for every overtime hour worked. So you would give them that supplement to put it all. So all it's all paid for under the 1.0 part of the formula. And then the overtime is paid at 50% and 100%. As long as you can pay that supplement, it makes it simpler that way. And if you're confused by what I just told you, I apologize. I can show you an example. But that's what we're dealing with. I live in this universe of math. It kind of makes us nuts after a while, you know. So you have to understand that. So, anyway, just to give you an example, if an employee earns $20 an hour and works 50 hours in a week, that's $1,000, right? Plus a flat sum bonus of $200 for the week, based on superb quality control performance. For a total of $1,200, the regular rate is $25, not $24 an hour. Remember, you're not taking the $1,200 and dividing it into all hours worked. You're dividing the $200 into 40, and you're dividing the $1,000 into 50. Isn't that interesting? So the correct two-step formula would be $1,000 divided by 50 is $20. And $200 divided by 40 is $5. And that's what you get. And so basically, this is a $25 regular rate, even though the calculation of the overtime is going to be two-stepped. You can't just, you have to set it up so that it's paid properly. But nonetheless, the regular rate is still, you can still arrive at what the regular rate is for purposes of supplementing the meal premium. So if you supplement the meal premium, you're not going to supplement it based on 25. Based on 24, you're going to supplement it based on 25 if any portion of this pay is delayed, like the and so this example here is only talking about it all in one pay period, so you're not having to delay anything. It's all getting done all at one time. Okay, the regular rate for salaried employees is 1/40. We've talked about that already, so it gives you a higher rate of pay for $2,000 per week, for example. An employee working 40 hours would get $50 an hour. It depends, because you're dividing by 40, even if the person worked, 50 hours, you only divide by no greater than 40 hours. Okay. So regular rate errors, there's liability for meal rest period premium calculation. Okay. What are some of the consequences of a regular rate error? Okay. Well, in the first column here on our left, we can see that there's a minimum wage and statutory pay issue. If there is an underpayment of the minimum wage, it will impact the regular rate, since additional minimum wages will increase the regular rate. So be sure and not have that problem, because remember, you got to do the regular rate correctly. Otherwise, you won't be supplementing correctly. If you're not accounting for all hours worked properly, all non-sales activity, for example, if you're monitoring that. If somebody's doing a whole bunch of, moving cars around or doing other things and you're not recording it, there is a minimum wage violation because they're performing that work free of charge if they're not getting a base for all hours worked. So that underpayment will result in owed minimum wages. And so you could have a regular rate error, which could also make your meal period premium underpaid, or your rest period premium underpaid, or possibly your heat recovery period underpaid. Okay, overtime calculation, we know that if the regular rate's not calculated correctly, there'll be an underpayment of minimum wages. It will impact the regular rate as well, because the regular rate is it's going to increase if you're adding more minimum wages to the formula. Okay, and so the bottom line is there'll be additional rest recovery pay, if you're paying that extra bump for rest recovery pay under that special formula that we've talked to many of you about, if you have to add more minimum wages, then even the rest recovery period rate will increase as well. So there's a lot of errors that could be created by simply doing the regular rate wrong. Okay. So here's somebody by the name of Sandy Armbandy. She's paid every week and earned an hourly rate of $20 an hour and earned 50 hours, including 10 hours, and worked 50 hours, including 10 hours of overtime for a total of $1,000. She was required to work through one meal period and paid a $27.50 premium. And you'll see how we got to that amount. Plus, she's paid a $250 commission for the week. Okay. Plus, she earned a flat sum bonus of $100 for a weekly quality award. Plus, she earned a monthly performance bonus of $1,750, a unit bonus, and worked 170 hours for the month with 20 hours of overtime. So these are all the magic numbers that we need in order to generate the regular rate calculations. Now, I don't expect the lights to turn on when you hear me talk about this. And again, you're going to be able to, I've provided a copy of this PowerPoint to the administrators here, so you can get a copy of this to take a look at if you need to. But the calculation here, we have something called a blended regular rate because we have all these different forms of pay here, okay? We're getting $20 per hour for the hourly rate pay for which $1,000 was earned, okay? Then we're getting the equivalent of $5 per hour for the commission, okay? Because you divide commissions into all hours work because you're continuing to earn, or at least you're able to earn commissions potentially during your overtime hours. So you can use the 50 to determine what that part of the regular rate consists of. Then we got the $100 flat sum bonus, okay? And that's also weekly in nature, but we have to divide that by 40, and that's an equivalent rate of 250. So we know adding all these things together, $20 an hour, $5 an hour, $250 an hour, that we have a $27.50 regular rate that we know of so far. Now, in terms of the monthly bonus, we don't know yet whether the person's going to get a monthly bonus. But it turns out that the person does get a monthly bonus, a unit bonus of $1,750. And because the person worked 170 hours for the month, we divided it into 170. So in addition to her $27.50 meal premium, Sandy's entitled to a supplemental meal premium of $10.29, because remember, $10.29 is the result of dividing $17.50 into $170. And so we know that's extra money that has to be supplemented. And by the way, the person is owed overtime on that as well. If there's 20 hours of overtime due, then you take $10.29 times 0.5 and then times the 20 hours of overtime to get that additional overtime of $102.90 that's owed. Now, again, I'm adding this note down here at the bottom. Monthly incentive pay also may warrant supplemental meal period, sick pay, and rest period pay if employee were paid by piece rate. Okay, so just keep in mind, and the sick pay is often overlooked if you're paying based on the regular rate. So, potentially, when you do your 90-day look back, I mean, remember, it's always changing. You got to keep doing your 90-day look back to find out what the rate actually winds up being for sick pay purposes, okay? So if any of you were a little bit confused by me going through this so quickly, I've had partners in my law firm have accused me, slow down, I don't understand. sometimes I'm guilty of that, where I go too fast because I figure, you're moving with me. Anyway. So the FARA case did not change. I want you all to remember this if you don't remember anything else. The FARA case did not change the rules for the regular rate calculation it used for overtime pay, but only made clear that the meal rest recovery period calculation is 1 hour at the regular rate that is used for overtime calculations. So the regular rate is a term of art. It's a buzzword. It's a magic word, and we can't give our own private meaning to it. So the regular rate calculation has always been potentially complicated, especially with many pay elements. One of the things I specialize in calculators, I get excited when somebody brings to me a compensation plan that's complicated with all these different elements, because then it allows me to toy around with the numbers. It allows me to experiment and to think about fun ways to deal with all those numbers. For me, I enjoy it. other people think it's absurd for me to enjoy it, but I do. But with many elements, I helped some, one of my partners wrote a textbook for summarizing wage and hour law, Jim McDonald. He's a great, great smart guy, and he's the regional manager in our Irvine office. And he asked me to help him with his manual for California wage and hour law synopsis, so that he could use that, you know, for his book. And so I did, and I went in there and I gave examples of overtime calculations and things like that. But I made them as simple as possible. I did just the opposite, because I did not want to overwhelm anybody, and plus I didn't want to screw up. So if I make it too complicated, I might even get it wrong myself. So I don't like that to happen. So I made it really simple. And it was still fun. And sometimes it's fun making things simple, not just making things complicated, because with simple formulas and simple compensation plans, you have less opportunities for error, even though sometimes it's fun to see how complicated things can get. Employers nonetheless may desire to revise their pay system so that the regular rate calculation is more simple. That's my point, where there's less elements. And there's a lot of ways of doing that. I have hundreds of ways of making compensation plans more simple. Doesn't always motivate them as much, but simple sometimes can be better. Employers may desire to revise their pay system so that the regular rate calculation is not delayed, so that you no longer have monthly bonuses, you no longer have quarterly bonuses. Now, one of the things, a lot of people don't know this, but I'm a psychology major. I have a bachelor's degree in psychology. And as I was in that field, I did experiments on animals. I didn't do anything inhumane, I promise you that. But I experimented on chickens, where we gave them certain schedules of reinforcement, where we gave them they pecked so many times, the food magazine would open and drop down so that they could eat. And we figured out ways where they would be more motivated, ways that they would be less motivated. And this is what it was all about. And so what does this have to do with compensation plans that have commission elements in them? Well, here's what it has to do with. We find that in animal studies, that the more frequently you reward them for doing something without delay, the higher performance you'll get from them. Now, why aren't auto dealerships paying people every week? Because it's too darn expensive. Plus, there's a PAGA penalty for every pay period in which a violation occurs. So you have way more many penalties that are possible if you have a weekly pay period than if you just have a semi-monthly pay period. So the bottom line is that there's many reasons that people don't pay weekly, but there still are those. Occasionally, I have a car dealership that pays people weekly instead of biweekly or semi-monthly. But nonetheless, you're not necessarily going to be hurt. If you can afford it and you can pay somebody all their bonuses in a semi-monthly range, like, for example, you're already doing it for the most part for technicians. You're paying technicians semi-monthly or biweekly. And they're getting all of it typically. Occasionally, there's a monthly award that they get. Some of our dealerships pay a monthly incentive, but maybe you'll want to reconsider that. Maybe not do that anymore. Maybe get rid of your quarterly bonuses. Put all your money in the pay period where you want them to perform in a maximal way. Give them more money quickly, and the benefit to that may well be higher levels of productivity over time. Animal experiments prove that they will produce higher amounts. And we're not like all animals necessarily, but they have found comparability to human behavior in many cases. And so that's a really fascinating thing, making it so that the bonuses are not all over the map. I don't think this is gonna always be possible, because some types of pay systems don't allow you to pay frequently. Some of the cycles for commissions are more easily done monthly. It's very hard to do semi-monthly, although it's more popular now, people doing semi-monthly pay systems. But clearly, quarterly bonuses are rare in the auto dealerships, save for those that are maybe sales managers and general managers. Most of the time, it's all getting washed out at the month with an occasional annual bonus. So you should first recognize that making a compensation system more simple may defeat other goals. Okay, so just realize that. You have to work through this, and I can help you. I can help you work through this. Okay. I apologize. I had my landline here went off, and it's a little bit of a distraction. Okay, now I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but you have to get your pay right for your bonuses and your incentive pay. you have to figure out what your grace periods are in every pay period. You know you have to pay people by certain deadlines and all that, but that's something for another day. You got to do that right, though, because there is a one pay period grace for non-scheduled overtime and semi-monthly rest recovery period pay. You have extra time to calculate your pay in really difficult situations, particularly when overtime's involved. You might be able to take advantage of that, but in certain situations. Just remember that Labor Code Section 204 requires that the frequency in which you have to pay people and also the deadline. We know now after the Omine versus Delta Airlines case that if you don't pay everything that's owed within the pay period, that could be a violation of Section 210 of the Labor Code. So it needs to be accurately calculated as well. We had some of our rounding cases, like the See's Candy cases, where the court was saying for the rounding cases that it wasn't a 204 violation if your rounding over time was underpaid in some pay periods, but not in others. It wasn't a violation of Section 204. But I don't know that that's going to continue to be the law with all these different cases coming out, including the Donahue case that says that you can't round for meal period compliance. So it's creating some tension now to reconsider rounding, although so far rounding is still permitted for reasons other than determining meal and rest period compliance. Okay, so again, make sure that you know your pay frequencies. You can look through this and let me know if you have any questions about that. But you should continue to make use of technology. Using Excel calculators is a good way to do it. You got to be very careful, though, because if there's an error in the calculator, and we don't guarantee a calculator if we give you one, you have to check it on your end. If there's an error in it, it can be perpetuated for many people. And so you want to, you know, do a couple manual checks on what's in the calculator, make sure you're getting the right stuff. Because sometimes things can get bypassed. Sometimes in taking an individual calculator and populating it over many different tabs, in the process of doing that, you could get something out of symmetry so that you're actually no longer calculating something correctly. A cell could be whited out. It could be modified. It could show errors. There's a lot of things that could happen here. When you're not locking your cells, you have a low-paid payroll clerk who can screw the cell up, and all you know is the general manager seems really happy because there's almost no overtime paid. But when he finds out it was because of an error in the calculator, he's not going to be happy about that, okay, because everybody wants to comply, okay? So,
John, can I?
Yes.
I've never had this happen before, so it says time remaining is 3 minutes. So if something happens and we all get kicked out, I will restart another meeting.
Okay.
So I don't know why. I've never had this happen, and I don't know what that means. So
I understand.
If something happens and it stops the meeting, I will send everybody a link and just dial back in.
Okay, great. All right.
Okay. Sorry about that, everybody.
That's okay. Thanks for the heads up. Okay. So let me see where we are here. Okay, so we're talking about, I got some pros and cons to the Excel calculators. I also talked a little bit about the minimum wage laws, and we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on that but it is important to get the minimum wage correctly so that your regular rate will be correct. So I'm not going to, you know, talk about unlawful averaging and borrowing and all that, because that all comes down to the technicalities of the minimum wage law. And we're not really talking about minimum wage in great detail today, but we are talking about all these different methodologies that you can use for paying people. And here's just a summary of those. And there's many, many different ways of paying people. I've seen so many different creative things. And I have some really great options, how to pay technicians, how to pay regular salespeople in ways that they could be motivated differently. I think it's always good to try to keep people motivated. Sometimes it takes. So the bottom line is the calculation regular rate is very complex. There's many derivative compliance consequences and related landmines for violations and PAGA lawsuits. The incorrect regular rate calculations can lead to government audits and lawsuits tied to meal, rest, and recovery period violations. Employers should not forget, and I'm reading verbatim, to investigate meal, rest, recovery period violations to avoid having to pay meal period premiums. I don't like if my clients have to pay these darn things. When I hear that they're paying them, I said, why is this happening? You cannot let it happen. You should make sure that you're compliant. However, If you never pay a meal period premium at all under any circumstances, that's going to look very suspicious. So you have to pay them when they're due, but you shouldn't be paying them very much if you take steps to comply. Okay, so you should conduct internal audits, among other things, to determine payroll issues related to meal rest recovery periods, minimum wage, and calculation of overtime. If you use incorrect procedures to calculate the regular rate or the meal rest recovery period premium, you should seek legal counsel to address exposure and resolution. What are you going to do? Are you going to retroactively pay everybody? And if you do, how are you going to do it? Are you going to try to do it formally in a settlement, or are you going to try to do it in some other method? So, you know, the bottom line is you need to get legal counsel in a situation where you are, where you do find that errors have been made. And there errors will be made. You will make mistakes. I mean, we human beings are capable of doing things wrong from time to time, as you know. And if you don't know, you're probably not married. So if there's any questions now, I'll be happy to entertain them. But this is the fundamental basis for the new law out now, which basically says simply that a meal rest recovery period violations have to be paid at the regular rate of pay that's used in calculating overtime. And the consequences of basing it on the regular rate is that you will have to pay more than you thought you might have to pay within the pay period, if there's other forms of pay that apply to that pay period. Plus, you may have to pay a supplement later on if there is a bonus that covers a larger pay period, including the pay period now in which you only paid what you could calculate at the time. So I hope this is helpful. And I will just open this up for any questions somebody may have.
Okay, so again, I don't know what's going to happen when the timer runs out. I don't see the timer. So I asked Karina, she said it was like 30 seconds. So I don't know. Is the timer stopped?
Maybe we can wait 30 seconds and see what happens.
The timer stopped and now it says exceeded by.
Okay. Now so the timer is cut us off. Okay. Right. Good. All right. I'm like freaking out. I'm like, what are you talking about? Okay. So I'm not sure if you can see the chat, John.
Okay. I can at this point. Should I get out of my stop sharing?
Well, if you just click the button on the bottom where it shows the, like, there's a little window, it tells you how many people are here, and then it says chat.
Oh.
So it's the button right next to the people.
Hold on. Let me see if I can, I think I'm going to stop sharing so that,
okay.
I think it will be easier if I stop sharing.
Now towards the bottom, it says meeting information. And then right next to that is the chat.
Okay. Oh, there we go.
So if you click that open.
Okay.
You will see there are some questions there. Colleen, are you still here?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So I don't know if you want to ask him. It might be easier for you to ask him than for him to read all that.
Okay. So we have people that come in at 7 a.m. They don't want to take their lunch till 1, but it's their choice. Do we have to pay them a penalty for taking their lunch late?
Technically you don't, but you have to go through, you know, there may be a dispute later on as to whether they were pressured to do it or whatever, but there has to be some kind of memorialization. Maybe they send you an email saying, by the way, I just, you know, I really don't want to take it until this time. But what you do technically have to do is, in responding to an email like that, assuming that you want to allow it to happen, some of my clients, I tell them not to allow them to do it because it just creates too many. Here's an example. We have a situation in one of our dealerships in Orange County where we have a lot of Hispanic workers that work together. Okay. And they started developing this deviation where they would not take a rest period in the morning. They wouldn't take it. Then they would have their lunch. And then they would take two rest periods together in the afternoon for 20 minutes. So they would have a 30-minute lunch and a 20-minute rest period the second half of the day. Okay, now, so we had a lawsuit filed. And we now know that the labor commissioner won't permit that to happen. Now, why is that? When these employees did it completely, it was on their own. I mean, it was clearly something that they agreed to do, and they wanted to do it. It worked out better. They could have their little fiestas and meals and all that. And it was kind of like a maybe a cultural thing. They loved it because I've seen it happen before. Here's the problem. When you have a group practice like that, that you put your imprimatur on and you permit to happen, how can you control the situation where one or two of the people in the group really don't want to do it that way, but their whole system is set up so that nobody's getting their break in the morning and they're all doing it? What if somebody has, you know, diabetes or they need to eat and, you know, and for their health? And no, they're having to wait till the afternoon and they don't even get a break at all. So no, the labor commissioner won't permit it, even though it is a voluntary deviation. Now, similar situation could occur if everybody says, well, and they're all in a group, we don't want to have it until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, even though we start at 7. And, you know, so the whole group goes out and they start, you know, feeling the pressure that, you know, they're not going to have their meal period earlier when some may feel that they do. So I think there could be a question as to whether there was people felt compelled to do it or pressured to do it because it was busier in the earlier part of the day and they had to get caught up or whatever. I just think it's dangerous to let people do that. But if you do let them do it, I think, number one, you have to have a written statement from them. I would not set up a, I agree to start late agreement. I wouldn't go that far because, I mean, once again, you're creating a policy that people might feel compelled to do if things get real busy. But if they send you an email saying, or you can send them an email, hey, I noticed that you started your meal at 1 o'clock. You realize that we relieve everybody of duty at 79, 10, yeah, we relieve everybody at noon. I mean, that's when you're relieved of duty. And you're free to do anything you want, and we will let you work. You don't have to let them work, but we will let you continue to work. But you are relieved of duty during that time, even though you took your meal, you know, late at 1 o'clock. You can set something up like that. It's just, it's odd. It's really strange. And the courts have not dealt with it very much. And I think there needs to be something in writing. And you need to tell the people, if you're willing to take the risk to do this, you need to get back with them clearly. Maybe have it in a response to an email. You're relieved of duty at 12 noon. This is what we require. We will let you continue to work, but we reserve the right at any time to, you know, reconsider our policy and require you to take it at 12 and better start planning for that because that's what we're going to do. We're probably going to abandon the policy, but for the time being, yeah. To me, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it myself. I would never let anybody start late under any circumstance because, remember, the time card itself will be deviant. The time card itself will show that they're starting at the sixth hour, at the end of the sixth hour they're taking.
Right.
And so automatically the burden shifts to you, and you might do okay in that burden, but maybe not with everybody. I just think it creates a bad record for an audit, and it just, it's risky. So that's kind of like my long answer to a problem. Now, I had a situation where I had a class action settle in the Riverside area. Actually, it was in Riverside County in Corona. There was one of our manufacturing clients there. You probably didn't think there was manufacturing at Corona, but there is. And they had a bell system for their meal periods. And on that bell system, they had them at the end of the sixth hour every day, they had a meal. Similar to this. They're all coming in early at 7 or whatever. And at the sixth hour at 1, they're taking their meal period. And the bell went off. The bell went off. Now, of course, they got in trouble for that because that's when the employer set up the sixth hour. And so they had to wind up paying about $800,000 to settle that lawsuit. But if the employees say they want to do it, you know, just be ready to have a fight if somebody challenges it, that it's really coerced or whatever, because your time cards are going to be deviant. And it's possible the labor commissioner could invalidate it because you honored the policy by officially acknowledging that you were going to let them do it. And so it almost appears like a ratification. So for the same reason that you can't accumulate rest periods and take them later in the day, I think to let somebody take their lunch at the end of the sixth hour would create a similar liability. And it's likely that the labor commissioner, if they audit you, they will say it's illegal.
Okay. My next question was, I know that there's people that don't take a break. We have a schedule where we assign people certain time frames to take their morning break and take their evening break, afternoon break. But I see that some people, usually the same people, they don't take a break at all.
because of the Brinker case, do we have to force them to take a break?
So is this a meal break or a rest break?
Rest break.
Okay. Rest now for rest breaks are a whole different universe. The standard for rest breaks, you know, you really can. I mean, an employee, meal periods can only be waived in two situations, you know, technically. You always have to relieve people for meal periods, except in the two situations. If they don't work more than 6 hours, they can waive the first. If they don't work more than 12 hours, they can waive the second one, second meal period, as long as they didn't skip the first one. That's already the law, and that's the only time that you can say, I'm not going to relieve you, you got to keep working. If you you can, you know, skip it as long as you agree, as long as we both agree. But with rest periods, it's different. In rest periods, you can always waive a rest break. I mean, if you as an employee don't want to stop and rest, you don't have to stop and rest. But the problem is that they're not recorded and it's hard to prove. So we usually make sure that they have an acknowledgement. I hereby acknowledge that I was authorized and permitted to take a rest period for every 4 hours of work or major fraction thereof. And, and insofar as practicable in the middle of the working period, there's much more flexibility in waiving rest breaks than there are with meal periods, with the exception, if you have an official policy of allowing people to accumulate rest breaks all at one time at a later point in the day, that has been viewed to be coercive. And if they make sure that when they sign their acknowledgments every pay period, and they're not actually taking the rest periods, they're not recorded anyway, right? And they're paid, you know, a meal period's different. You're not getting paid for the meal period. It's time off, whereas rest period, they're getting paid for the rest period. They don't actually want to rest, or if they're a technician, they want to keep working because they want to make more money. It's absolutely okay, as long as, you know, they've acknowledged in their, you know, when they acknowledge where it says, I hereby acknowledge that I was authorized and permitted. They still may later say that they felt coerced to sign the acknowledgement, and that they really felt pressured to keep pushing the work out because there was a customer waiting in the parking lot and the service advisor kept coming back to me and badgering me. So, the bottom line is that, you know, you can police them and make sure they take them if you want to. But I would say that it's almost impossible for an employer to be that much on top of things with employees unless you're making them all take it at the same time. And you can't do that because you got to stagger it sometimes so that all the work's getting done. Okay. So everybody's going to be taking it at a different point in time during the shift. It's very difficult. So you need to be able to sign to have them sign those acknowledgments. I think for meal periods, it's a little bit more dicey because the lack of compliance for a meal period is painfully obvious because it's shown on the time record. And with rest periods, it's just your word against theirs. And if they're acknowledging it and they're saying that it was made available, and plus they're getting paid for the time, it's just harder. A lot of attorneys out there that I deal with in these cases, they really have a hard time, litigating a rest period case when they're signing these acknowledgments. They really do. It's much more difficult for them to say, for them to prove in court that their people didn't get a rest period when they're not recording them, when they can take them whenever they want, and there's no evidence that somebody made them work continually. So that's the bottom line. It's a little more difficult to prove a rest period claim. There's a lot more problems that we have with rest periods where people are not paying them at the proper rate, or they're doing something technically wrong with the rest periods other than actually providing the rest periods.
Okay, my last question is on salespeople. The rate that we have to pay salespeople for rest breaks, is that change every pay period due to their commissions, even if they're not due any overtime? We don't pay an hourly rate to our salespeople. They're on straight commissions. So would we have to manually calculate the rate every pay period?
Yes. But are you paying semi-monthly or monthly for your?
We're paying semi-monthly, and we're paying them at minimum wage for salespeople.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. There'll be a regular rate that is a combination, because I know that you have non-sales activity. You're paying some time for that maybe, and you're paying for rest breaks, and you're also paying for commissions. You're going to come up with what they call a blended regular rate every semi-monthly pay period. And it'll be different every semi. Yes. So the short answer is yes, the rate will be different. You will no longer pay the meal period premium if they missed a break. And remember, You don't pay them that premium simply because they skip two rest breaks. If they voluntarily skip those, you won't have to pay them a premium. But if you do have to pay a premium because you prevented them from taking it, or they were required to work through their break, then yes, the rate will be different every pay period where the fluctuating amounts of pay are changing. And they will be, because it's no longer just about the minimum wage that you're paying for the premium.
Okay, we don't know if they took it or not. We're just automatically paying them. For 8 hours a day, we pay them 20 minutes at minimum wage. We don't know if they took it or not.
Okay, right. Well, the thing is, and that's a common practice, by the way, because, I mean, if it turns out that they didn't take it, you're actually giving them extra money, right? You're paying them more money, technically, than what they would be due. But I think the common practice out there is to allocate the time so that they can't later say that they were disincentivized from taking the break because, you know, sometimes you didn't do your accounting right and you didn't pay them for the break. Here, you're always paying them for the time that's allocated for those breaks. And so that is credited toward the regular rate. Now, of course, you know, it's possible that somebody could come back and say, well, actually, my regular rate should be higher because I didn't take my break and I was actually paid the money. And I don't know mathematically if they can get there in that kind of an argument. I think that it's the humanitarian thing to automatically assess the amount for rest period times without regard to whether they take it. And let's remember, the rest period time that is paid separately, it's not the actual amount of time they take it anyway. Somebody could take a 20-minute break when they only get a 10-minute break, but you're only going to be paying the 10 minutes. That 20 minutes of wasted time when they sat in the break room, that is going to be non-productive production time. They're wasting their production. In other words, you're not preventing them from earning more money when they have exceeded that 10 minutes. If they take a lengthy break or a smoking break or whatever, that's just become non-productive time. And people paid on a hybrid basis where you're paying them separately for the rest break time, you know, you technically don't have to pay any more for that time than what you would pay for the legally required amount of breaks. And that's the amount that people typically allocate. Okay. So if they waste their time, then that's really on you to go after them and make sure they get out there and back there selling again, you know, bottom line. Does that help?
So I think the answer to the question is we are not supposed to pay the minimum wage to salespeople. We have to calculate what their regular rate of pay would be based on the commissions they made in that 2 week period and pay them a rest break.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, what you're asking a different question. Okay.
Yes.
The time that people spend on rest breaks is a different issue than the premium that's charged for violating the rest break laws. Okay. That's the regular rate. So what I'm trying to say is like in the example of somebody who makes a bonus, when somebody makes a bonus, it's basically allocated to all the hours in the day that they work. And so their regular rate, which they get for being on their rest break, will consist not only of the minimum wage that you pay for that break, but the regular rate for purposes of calculating overtime will include the other forms of pay. But that doesn't mean that you pay the salesperson necessarily like you would pay the technician, where you have that special formula where you back in the rate, where you increase their regular rate
right
due to that formula. Now, that being said, when salespeople get like units, when they get like unit bonuses or different types of pay that way, I actually recommend that they get a shifting formula for their rest breaks that's similar to the technicians, because, you know, unit bonuses and things that look like a piece rate actually suggests that they need to be paid that rate based on 226.2 of the labor code. Okay. Which requires the rest breaks to be paid at the higher of the applicable minimum wage, or the rate that's calculated by looking at all productive pay except pay on for rest periods divided by all hours worked except time spent on rest periods. So they get this special productive rate. If it's higher than the minimum wage or the applicable base that you're paying on the break, then you pay the higher amount. But that's not officially required for commission paid employees unless they also get a piece rate type bonus. That law applies to piece rate paid employees. You can continue to pay If you don't have that in, say a person's just getting commissions and they're not getting unit bonuses or piece rates or anything else, they're just getting commissions, okay?
Yes.
Technically, you can continue to pay for the rest breaks themselves, the minimum wage, if you're paying them on a hybrid method. It may be that the regular rate winds up being higher than that because they get commissions also. But that doesn't mean that you have to pay for the time that they're on their breaks at the higher rate. You know, that's a different question. Time being spent on the rest break is different than time that would be used in calculating overtime, which counts for all hours work, which could include bonuses and everything else. Let me give you another example on this. Okay. Let's say that somebody has a special rate of pay. The person normally gets $20 an hour, but when that person is traveling, you ask the person, you're going to pay the person only minimum wage for travel. Okay. So in a particular work week, an employee travels for 2 hours at minimum wage, and that same employee travels for 38 hours, or you can say 40 hours, so it makes overtime, 40 hours at the $20 an hour rate. So what is the regular rate of pay for that week? You have to use the blended rate. You have to blend. You have to take 40 hours times 20. And what is that? That's about $800, I think. And then you would take the 2 hours for travel, multiply that times the minimum wage. And then you get the total amount of money due, and you divide that into the 42 hours. And you'll get a rate that's higher than the minimum wage that you're paying the person to travel. But that doesn't mean that you're paying the travel time itself, the straight time portion of that, at a higher rate. They're still going to get paid minimum wage for the travel, but when it comes to overtime, they're going to get a premium that reflects the blended rate for all the pay. And mathematically, I can show you how that works. But I'm essentially saying the same thing for the people that are paid rest breaks at minimum wage. If they're getting paid rest breaks at minimum wage, and they're getting paid all kinds of other amounts of pay at higher rates of pay, commissions and everything else, you find out at the end of the week what the blended rate is. And that's the rate that's used for calculation of overtime. That doesn't change the fact that you can pay the minimum wage for the rest breaks themselves. I can show how that works mathematically, but that's the reality of what you're dealing with. Now, all that being said, I'm an advocate for paying. I'm starting to advocate for my clients to start paying the rest break time, the time they spend on rest breaks, at this blended rate that they're using for technicians, because this way they're not ever going to be at disadvantaged for taking a break, because they'll be paid that break at their productive rate. It's okay. Not exactly the regular rate. There's a special formula that's used to do that, and it's under Section 226.2 of the Labor Code.
All right. I would like that worksheet if you can send it to me. That'd be sure. Great.
Right. And so just to clarify, which worksheet do you want? You want the worksheet that would pay them more like the technicians at that blended rate? Or would you like to me just to demonstrate to you on a calculator how they could be making minimum wage for a rest break and yet have a higher regular rate for purposes of overtime pay?
The second one.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
Okay. You're welcome.
Anybody else have a question? You can unmute yourself if you would like to ask a question.